And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, the series POV is airing a superb new documentary called The Overnighters. This film focuses on a small community in North Dakota, which, like a number of small communities around it, has been drastically transformed over the last few years by the emergence of a technology known as fracking, which has allowed a booming oil industry to emerge. And this has drawn to North Dakota men by the thousands in sort of a modern-day gold rush in search of new lives, exciting new opportunities for themselves to have well-paying jobs in the oil industry. It has been a bewildering transformation for many of those who live in these communities. The film tells the story of a Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor who has decided to turn his own church into something of a dorm and counseling center for literally hundreds of these men, many of whom come to this town with very checkered pasts and troubling baggage. It's a story of compassion, which in a sense goes very sadly wrong. The director, producer, and cinematographer for this poignant film is Jesse Moss. And again, the film is called The Overnighters. Tell our listeners the story of, well, first of all, why in general you were interested in kind of this overall story of this mad rush to the state of North Dakota. How does that line up with what already were some of your principal interests, particularly as a documentarian?
Well, you mentioned this age-old American story, the way in which what's happening in North Dakota echoes the Dust Bowl migration of the 30s and previous journeys to the frontier. And what I saw in Williston and western North Dakota was that story made new in the 21st century. And I was curious, what does a 21st century boom town look like and feel like? What was happening in Williston, North Dakota? And I was beginning to read some stories about the oil boom. And I was also interested in what the ground level experience was of these Americans who were making that journey, who were leaving their homes and their families behind and setting out to find new lives. And was the promise of the North Dakota oil boom an illusion or a reality? So I began to look around and actually read an article that Pastor Jay, who's the main character of my documentary, had published in his local paper, calling on his community to welcome these newcomers. And that piqued my curiosity, and I called Pastor Jay, and we spoke on the phone, and that's when he told me that there were men and women sleeping in his church who had no place to stay and couldn't afford housing in Williston. And that was the impetus to go up there and begin to look around.
Although this is not the primary focus of your film, and I'm sorry if I'm blindsiding you with a question like this, but I wonder if you could just speak briefly about this phenomenon, which has played out most dramatically in North Dakota with this new technology, which has in effect suddenly released to the world an oil source, which until recently simply wasn't there. What exactly is going on in a place like North Dakota? What is the technology which is suddenly unleashing oil that previously seemed not to be there?
So there was oil in North Dakota. There were previous oil booms, but what's happened is fracking or hydraulic fracturing technology has allowed more precise and deeper extraction of oil reserves or deposits. And the Bakken Shale region is this geological formation in western North Dakota, bleeds into Montana and up into Canada, that contains an enormous amount of oil and natural gas. And so fracking technology has allowed industry to extract this oil. Now, they drill as deep as 10,000 feet very precisely. It's very resource-intensive and expensive, but the returns are extraordinary. But what's happened in North Dakota is, we've seen this growth, certainly in Pennsylvania with natural gas extraction, but the industry has now gone where the resources are. That's what's changing in America, I think, now, is domestic energy production is driving an enormous amount of economic growth and job growth. energy production goes where the resources are. And in the case of Pennsylvania, there's really quite a bit of infrastructure already present to support that industry. But in a place like North Dakota, which is an agricultural state, not a very big population, there's really nothing up there. It's a pretty empty place. And yet there is this great treasure trove of resources. And as a result, everything has to come in, industry, men, equipment, you know, all of it. And that's what's really changed dramatically the way of life up there in a way that I don't think we've seen in other places in the United States where there already were rich deposits like Pennsylvania, like Oklahoma, Texas. I mean, there's already infrastructure there. So this influx, an enormous transformation, is felt more, I think, more acutely in a place like North Dakota, where there were just a collection of small agricultural towns that, in a very short period of time, starting in about 2008, 2009, and coincidentally, right around the time of the recession, this change begins to occur. And I think it becomes North Dakota, Western North Dakota, and the Bakken region becomes the bright spot in the American economy, the place where people can go to get a job. If they've lost their job in the wake of the recession, if they were employed in housing, home construction, they were tradesmen and manufacturing, all these industries that have suffered recently, those people look to North Dakota. And that's what I saw, and what I think what North Dakota began to experience was that massive migration of tens of thousands of people to a place that really didn't have much.
You focus on this little town of Williston, North Dakota. Are there all kinds of towns like Williston throughout the state? I mean, are there dozens more? Are there hundreds more? And is Williston a sort of an average example, or is it maybe an extreme example of what's been going on in that state?
Williston is the epicenter of the Bakken region, so it's where the major airport is. It's where I guess it's where many companies set up shop. But there are, I'd say, closer to five towns that are like Williston, relatively small, that have suddenly exploded. They're in Montana, the town of Sidney, Dickinson in North Dakota, and Watford City. So a couple others. There's not hundreds. And it's really the western region of North Dakota. So really probably about five towns, Williston being the biggest. And that's what drew me to Williston, really. It's positioned in the very center of this drama. And indeed, the place that people go when they come to North Dakota, if they don't know, they don't have a job lined up, and they don't know what they're going to do when they get there, but they get on the bus or they take the train or they hitchhike, the place they come to is Williston. And there, in some cases, to greet them was Pastor Jay, who is the center of my story.
One of the realities which we see in your film is that well-paying jobs, in fact, do not await each and every one of these people. And I keep saying men. There are a smattering of women as well, but it's almost entirely men who are making this long migration to North Dakota, and some of them land great jobs, the best-paying jobs they've maybe ever had, or have had in quite some time, and others do not. Is it that there, in fact, are not quite enough jobs to go around for the thousands of people flocking to North Dakota, or is that some of them come to North Dakota but in fact are not qualified for jobs that other people are able to get? I mean, why is it that in fact reality does not equal the sense of hope and promise with which so many travel there?
I think it's a few things. One is, I think many people have an idea that they're going to come there, even without experience in the oil industry, and land a job on an oil rig, which they've heard pays $40, $50 an hour with overtime. That's the big money. But that job is very specialized, hard to get, hard to hold, and many people are not qualified. But there are, and there were, I should say were, because the conditions are changing now in North Dakota. The price of oil has dropped rather dramatically, and I don't know that I could say it's busting, but it really, the climate has since changed, and But when I was making the film between 2011 and 2013, there were many jobs to be had and good, well-paying jobs. However, the other thing is people don't realize the cost of living in western North Dakota, in Williston, was equivalent to the cost of living in New York City, in Manhattan, or San Francisco. Williston, North Dakota, had the highest market rents in that period of any place in the United States.
Wow.
And so people would come, and they might get a job, and this was true of some people sleeping in Jay's Church. They didn't realize they still couldn't afford to live there. And I think the other factor is, as you point out, some of these people maybe can find a job, maybe can't hold it. You know, people come wanting to start new lives, but they bring their burdens with them, their problems, their pathologies, and reinventing yourself, starting a new life, isn't as easy as we imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly not easy in a place like Williston, where the conditions can be rough, people are lonely, they don't have a place to sleep. You know, that makes starting over very difficult. So I think all of these factors combine to make life just a little bit harder than people anticipate. And yet, I will say, there was work to be had, and there still is. I mean, there's just an awful lot of industry happening. And for people who were determined, there was work awaiting them. And everybody in my film, initially at least, was working. And I should say, there is a young man in my film from Wisconsin.
Yes.
Antigo. So there's a Wisconsin connection here. And it, you know, I return to his home later in the film.
His story is especially poignant. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jesse Moss, director, producer, and cinematographer for a really marvelous documentary, which is called The Overnighters. And this film, as we have just been talking about, focuses on one small town in North Dakota, Williston, North Dakota, and focuses particularly on one pastor there, the pastor of a small Lutheran church, Concordia Lutheran Church, which is, he is trying to do his part to offer a word of welcome, a place for some of these men to sleep, streaming into North Dakota in search of a new life. Jesse Moss, you mentioned that what specifically drew you to this town and to this man, to this pastor, Jay Reinke, was something which he wrote in the newspaper there. Tell us what he wrote and why it grabbed hold of you so powerfully. I mean, what in the world did he say that, in a sense, inspired you to drop whatever you were doing, wherever you were doing it, and move yourself to Williston, North Dakota?
Well, Pastor Jay stood up to his community, and he said, let's not fear these newcomers. Let's welcome them with open arms. However, what had happened just before he did that is there was a local school teacher in Sidney, Montana, who had been murdered by two men who had come up there to find work, but were on drugs, and it was a horrible crime, and it really cast a pall of fear across the entire region, and I think shaped the way many people, natives, looked at these newcomers. They saw criminals or people to fear, and in fact, most people coming, many, you know, the vast majority they're good people, but yet it was a polarizing, frightening crime. So Jay bravely stood up and said, you know, these are good people, these are Americans, they're here to work, let's help them. The problem is really not many other people stood up to say that. And Jay not only said that, but he acted on his principles. He decided to open his church. What happened is one person came to his door and said, I can't find a place to live, I have nowhere to sleep, can you help me? And Jay said, I think this is how Jay described it to me. He looked around, he's got a big and a rec room, recreation space in the church. And he said, sure, I've got room, sleep here. And from that one person grew this program, which he came to call the Overnighters Program. He called these men, and I say men too, because it was really predominantly men. There were a handful of women, but these men began to come, and more came to his door, and they heard about his program. through the grapevine. They would get off the bus in Williston, and someone would point them that direction. And Jay would open his door. And over time, this program developed. There were people, when I met Jay, the program had been running for about 6 months. It ultimately ran for 2 years. And at that six-month point, there were probably 40 or 50 men sleeping in the church, and dozens more sleeping in their cars in the parking lot of the church. And I was just struck when I first got to Williston, went to meet Jay, walked into his church and looked around and saw all of these guys and saw Jay's connection with them and the fact that these men, big tough guys, you know, roughnecks from Oklahoma, were weeping and they were distraught and scared, and they found sanctuary in this church, and they were here to look for work. And I began to film. I didn't know what the story was. I didn't know if Jay would be a character in my film. I just felt this was a prism. Jay's church and this program was a prism into this much bigger, really huge and overwhelming story of the entire transformation of North Dakota. And it felt to me, you know, when I walked into that room, it to me it felt like touching a live wire that arced back through American history to those towns that we have heard about, you know, Deadwood and Dodge City and San Francisco of 1849, these electrifying places that are kind of obscured by mythology now, but it felt suddenly made real to me, and the intensity of the experience, the volatility of the place. And here was Jay acting out of compassion, because this to him was an expression of the Christian ethic, to truly love his neighbor, to open his doors. The problem is that his congregation and his neighbors began to resent him and fear this program.
And
I could recognize that relatively early in my visit, and saw, okay, there's something boiling here.
So even as you arrived, that sort of mounting fear was already in place.
Jay made it clear to me. He said, I could lose my job for doing this. And I thought, okay, here's a story. This man is risking everything in his life to do what he believes is right. And, you know, for me, it was interesting because I didn't grow up in the church. I'm not Christian. And yet I really connected powerfully with Jay and his choice, because to me it struck me as, for him, a very Christian act, but for me a very moral choice to help people in need. And I thought, you know, that he's making a choice that we all make in large and small, or have to make in large and small ways in our own lives about helping people, and yet he's doing it in a very big way, and he's realizing that there may be consequences down the road.
Right, which of course there are. We're speaking with Jesse Moss about his POV documentary, The Overnighters, which airs tonight on Milwaukee Channel 10 and on PBS stations across the country. Jesse Moss, my understanding is that upon reading this column and actually connecting with Pastor Jay Reinke, then you, in a sense, not in a sense, you actually moved to Williston, North Dakota. And in fact, for the first 6 months, actually pretty much slept with amidst these men at Concordia Lutheran Church. Ahead of talking about that, what that was like, tell us about where you had been and the home which, in a sense, you were leaving behind. And you've mentioned at some point, I think, maybe before we went on the air, that you have a wife that assisted you with this film. So were you leaving a wife behind and kids or some other job? I mean, in what sort of way was this for you a migration similar to what these men were experiencing, leaving the familiarity of home far behind them?
I have a wife and two small children, and I did leave them. I did come back and forth, so I wasn't there for the entire duration of the 18 months that I spent shooting the film. I would go back and forth from my home. And I'm careful not to ever describe myself as an overnighter. I don't somehow feel like that's fair to what they experienced and who they were. But I will say that I went, I'm self-employed. This film wasn't funded when I began it. And I went in search of something that I'm not sure I could even define now. But went looking for a story to tell that felt important to me, unsure of what I would find. I did ask Jay if I could sleep in the church because I had no place to stay. All of the hotels in Williston were booked solid by oil companies, basically owned by oil companies. And it was very hard, very expensive to find anything for myself. And Jay said, of course you can sleep here. And that began a six-month period that I slept in the church amongst the men, which for me was both the foundation of the film and what it would become, and life-changing, just to be there and to be right inside this story and this community. And it was not the most comfortable nights of sleep, but I treasured every night I spent there. It was an incredible community, this ad hoc community of men, so different in every respect. You know, I expected to find kind of classic redneck, a roughneck, you know, some guy with oil industry experience. But I would say what I found was really America, but a male, mostly male America, but men with PhDs, men with no education, African immigrants, you know, men from the heartland. I mean, there was just a vast range of people sleeping in this church and also becoming a community unto itself. I mean, just making connections with each other. I think so many people had come alone, and I think it's part of the human instinct for survival that you need to kind of reach out and connect with others. And that's what made them so open. And I think what I discovered as a storyteller was how unusually open and willing to connect people were to me and to my camera as I began to tell the story. And Jay's connection with them, his connections were very deep. And I think he was giving them not only space to sleep, but in some cases, love, emotional support, guidance, advice. He would lend them $20. I mean, he was beginning to kind of give his whole self to these people. So it was an incredible community. And I also sensed that it wouldn't last. It felt transitory. And I thought, I've got to capture it. Because this is not a history that gets told, I think, in history books. No one will know the Sever was here. And yet it's something meaningful. And I don't know what it is, but I'm just going to film it. What it becomes.
In the essay that appears on the POV website, your filmmaker's statement, which is very well written, by the way, and I really encourage people to take a look at that before watching the film tonight. At one point you write, the church, meaning Concordia Lutheran Church, where these men were staying, about 50 when you first got there. You write, the church was a raw, emotional place. Desperation forces people to drop their usual defenses. Men cried as they showed me pictures of their children. They told me about their dreams of lucrative jobs on the oil rigs that checkered the prairie landscape. I decided to stay and film. But I was so struck by that notion of how desperation, in many cases, can force us to drop our defenses. I think we don't always think of it that way. Sometimes we think of when life gets tough, we clam up, we close up, we recede into ourselves, but not always. And particularly when we are far from home. I mean, somebody might react that way, but many other people obviously find themselves opening up because they simply have to. How surprised were you by the openness of these men to share themselves with you in such open emotional fashion?
And that's what got me. It grabbed me and pulled me in. And you know, this was a place of last resort. I mean, in their lives, these are not men who had other options. You know, you didn't make that journey to North Dakota and leave everything behind if you had other options in your life. And that's what I felt with them, is these were guys, they had nothing to go back to if they failed, right? The stakes couldn't have been higher. It wasn't, in a way, a kind of life or death, you know? I mean, not mortal true death, but like a kind of living death if they didn't succeed, because this was the only place in America they felt they could find work. And they all, I found it very sympathetic, and this, and I wanted to show this in the film, but the what work means to them in their lives and their sense of their, you know, their selves. And I wanted to show them finding work and what work, that work itself would deliver to them and their sense of self. And you see that, how some of these guys, Michael, who's an electrician from Georgia, who had left a family behind, who, when I met him, was in tears in the church. And, petrified and almost ready to give up and go home, to put to nothing, I mean, to failure. And yet he perseveres and he finds a job as an electrician, which is what he's been trained to do. And you see a kind of physical transformation in him, and see that he's actually good at what he does. And this is where he's been able to find that work and that meaning in his life. And I guess I felt that about many of them. And I wanted to be there long enough to see whether or not they could find that thing. And not, Gopher, not, it's not always, you see this in the film for these men, it's often work, but it's often something else as well, which is a kind of salvation of the soul. I mean, a kind of deeper, for Alan, for example, who's a man who works, he helps the pastor run the program. He becomes the pastor's right-hand man. So actually not out working in the oil field, but for him, he's a guy who's done a hard time in prison, but he's found his way to North Dakota, and he's found purpose in helping the pastor run the program. And yet you feel within him that a kind of volatility, because he has a dark past, and he wants to put it behind him. We're not sure if he can.
I appreciate the fact that as we see not only Reverend J. Reinke's devotion to these men and his tireless efforts to make life better for them, that as we are shown those who have concerns and are very critical of this, and increasingly so as time goes on, I sense that you do not want his opponents to be demonized, and that you are careful to help us understand that, at least to some extent, some of these concerns, by no means all, but some of these concerns are probably well-founded, or at least we can understand where some of these people are coming from. I wonder if you could just say a word about how difficult that was. I suspect that you personally felt great affection for Pastor Reinke and came to really admire him for what he was doing. And so how tricky was it for you to, in a sense, treat with respect those who had a very, very different perspective on this situation in Williston?
It was very tricky. One of the trickiest parts of making this film was to represent their views, and I thought they were very legitimate, and I could sympathize. If suddenly I woke up one day and there was an encampment of unemployed men, some of whom had criminal records, living across the street from me, I'd be pretty freaked out too. And so I wanted to represent that very real debate that was happening in the church that Jay was engaged with every day, and they would talk about it. However, the congregation had really decided they didn't support the program, and they didn't necessarily want to open up that internal discussion to me and to my camera. And yet I think Jay felt, and I felt, like this is a real important and legitimate discussion about what the meaning of a congregation is, how you live a Christian life. I mean, these are profound questions that the church and the congregation and Jay were wrestling with. I thought, these are real questions, and there are not easy answers. And so let's open up this conversation. And yet the church, the congregation, was a bit sensitive. So I had to work, and it took time. I mean, this is where having the freedom of making an independent film helps, right? You know, I really had nothing but time, and so I could build some relationships and make connections with some members of the congregation who were more receptive to me and through those connections, I was able to ultimately bring in that that internal deliberation that I think is important to represent in the film. And I think we can all certainly sympathize with it. It makes a much more, I don't know, not necessarily a balanced story, but I think you see what Jay is up against and how the fact is, and much of this film presents complicated questions for which there are not easy answers. And I myself wrestled with that. You know, a lot of documentary work is kind of binary and sort of black, white, yes, no, good, bad. And this is a film and a story that really inhabited the gray, right? I mean, Jay's choices, these men, you know, these what to do about this. This was not, I mean, Jay's, I found it intensely sympathetic, but also complicated and boundary crossing and confrontational. And like, you know, you don't, I guess what I realized is that, you know, you got to be a certain kind of person to do something like this. I mean, most of us maybe in the abstract think, yeah, I could be that person who shelters the migrants in a storm. But you know what? Most of us are not. We're not. And you have to be, you got to have a little bit of an ego. You know, and Jay's a little bit, he'd be the first to admit it too. He told me, I mean, he's a little bit vain. He, you know, he questioned, but what I liked about Jay from the beginning is he was self-critical, self-aware. He said to me, Jesse, no one has pure motives. And I thought to myself, thanks for saying that. I like you more that you can admit that about yourself. And, you know, he said, Jesse, this film shouldn't be about me. You know, it should be about the program and about the men. But what I said back to him is I said, Jay, you are the program. You're the embodiment of what's happening here. There's nobody else. So it is going to be about you.
The interesting thing with one conversation when he starts going door to door and talks to neighbors and so on and trying to allay their fears and so on leads to a really interesting brief conversation with one of these men involving him cutting his hair. You remember the moment I'm talking about?
Sure. Yeah.
Tell listeners about that. I think it's a really interesting moment.
So, you know, Jay, he had these guys basically camping in the parking lot, and appearances were important to him. I mean, he was always hyper-conscious of how this would be perceived by the neighbors. It was a perception problem, and he recognized that, and it was a guy sleeping in the parking lot, and there's a very funny, I mean, I wish there were, Jay's a very funny man, and there was a guy sleeping in the parking lot who, has a ponytail and has he's got Kiss seat covers in his van and Jay tells him they have a funny exchange about that Kiss seat covers and Jay teases him about it and he asks the man to cut his hair, you know, and he's basically saying you're going to have an easier time getting a job here if you consider your appearance. And now, you know, you can interpret that a few different ways, and Jay, you know, Jay's a bit conservative, but he's right in some ways that appearance matters and how you present yourself if you're looking for work, we all know, is a factor. And so Jay says, cut your hair, and the guy says, Jesus had long hair, you know, and well, who knows, but that's what he says. And Jay says, well, Jesus didn't have my neighbor, and you know, Jay's got great comic timing, but he's right, you know, that's what he's up against, is he's got a bunch of neighbors looking out their windows, seeing these guys camped out there, and how they present themselves, whether or not they, I mean, this is not like a party spot, you know, and Jay didn't allow that, and yet, it's an unruly collection of characters, big personalities, and trying to maintain order, you see that in that particular scene, because Jay's kind of patrolling the parking lot at night, and you just get a tiny glimpse into what his everyday reality is, trying to manage this community and love everybody, you know, and help everybody. And he gives the guy $20 and tells this guy to cut his hair. And, you know, it's like every day for 2 years, that was Jay's struggle. And it began to grind him down, and you see a kind of mounting pressure in his life as he struggles to contain and to juggle all of these forces, to care for the overnighters. And you know, what I recognize in Jay when I first met him was that he had found a calling, and that these men the overnighters had become his true congregation. He didn't articulate that, but I could see that he had crossed a line in his life from which there was no going back. You know, he had sort of given up his Williston congregation and replaced it with the overnighters. And yet they were both existing, you know, they were both there at the church, and yet I could see that he would this wouldn't end well.
Hmm. You also
even, go ahead.
You also point out that in a sense that same problem begins to exist in terms of his own family, and the fact that although they by and large appreciate him and appreciate what he's doing, he begins to feel terribly guilty for having neglected his own family. You show that to us quite poignantly in one scene where the family is at what appears to be a high school football game where the pastor's son is playing. And but the voiceover sort of paints a picture of the pastor probably not getting to very many of those games or in other ways neglecting his own family. And one has a sense, too, of him being sort of drawn into this experience and at the outset never dreaming probably that this is where it was going to lead, where it would, in a sense, utterly
Absolutely.
Consume his life.
I think of it as a kind of a whirlpool, and he was drawn into it. And because some of these men had troubled lives and they required enormous emotional support, he became very invested in them, and to the point where he couldn't give everything he needed to everybody in his life. So not just the congregation, but his own family, who were very supportive of the program. And when you're, as you know, when you're you know, pastor's kids or pastor's family, it's you know, you're very, there's not a clear separation between your pastoral responsibilities to the church and your family commitments. It's sort of all folded in together, and the pastor's family is expected to be a part of that. And yet he was giving so much emotional energy to and love to this community of men, the overnighters, that he didn't have much left to give to other people in his life. And yet he couldn't stop. And this is a source of pain in his family, who he loves very much. He had, I think at the time I was filming, 3 children living at home, one off at college. And, you know, this, you begin to see the fractures in his family life through the course of the film, of course, and it explodes rather dramatically at the end of the film. But, this was just one more thing that Jay was struggling with. And yet I, you know, you see, and you can understand how he might become invested. I mean, it's also, he was as a pastor, you know, kind of a therapist. I mean, he's used to helping people through difficult times in their lives. I mean, it's what he's trained to do, what he loves to do. And yet these guys, they ask a lot of, you feel that acutely when this one man in particular comes to the church, who is sleeping in the parking lot, and turns out to be a registered sex offender, and when the newspaper learns about this, it threatens to derail the program, and Jay is faced with a terrible choice of, does he cast that man out because he can no longer stay in the church, or what does he do? And Jay makes that decision to bring that man into his home and to provide him a couch in his basement. And you could look at that one of two ways, either a real true test of his convictions or a reckless act, and maybe both.
Hmm. And of course, as you already said, this film is so much about the gray. And these, many of these men whom we meet, some of them we really come to admire and even love, and there are others whom we really feel some suspicion, and sometimes both. And there are at least a couple of figures in the film who sort of take us on a journey, as they find maybe the baggage of their lives sort of catching up with them in some really terrible ways, and in a couple of instances, Pastor Reinke has men to whom he has given so much, in a sense, turning on him in resentment and bitter anger over the way things have begun to turn out. And it makes one realize that when you reach out this hand of compassion, it can sometimes be a very, very complicated thing and much more difficult than one would ever imagine at the outset. I wonder if you could just say a word about the young man who's from Wisconsin, an overnighter from Antigo, Wisconsin, named Keegan Edwards. His story is particularly poignant, and I wonder if you would just say a word about him. I think some of our listeners will want to watch for him with special interest.
Sure. Keegan was a young man who, I think he was about 18 when I met him. I mean, a boy man, you know, this wonderful, big, strong kid. I met him one day. He walked into the church, and he was covered in oil. I mean, head to toe. And Jay said, "Stop right there. Don't come in." And made him change before he would come into the church. And he was one of these kids who'd really been put on a bus, I think, by his parents, and said, "Go make something of yourself." You know, and the place to do it is Williston, North Dakota. And so he, I felt a sense of vulnerability about Keegan, but also a wonderful sense of promise that here was the kid who was going to get a job on an oil rig. Right, because he was big and strong and willing to work hard, and I just something about him that grabbed me. His kind of his vulnerability and his strength, and I got to know him a little bit. And almost right after I met him, he moved out of the church, and he moved into a treehouse. He and a friend rented a treehouse. This is how desperate people were to find a place to live in Williston. They lived literally in a treehouse. And I think they were paying $100 a week, and I thought, man, this is what life is like for some of these guys. And I just began to film with Keegan, and he found I didn't know much about his family life at that point. I knew he had a girlfriend and a little baby that he wanted to bring out to live with him, and so I began to follow his story, and he found a job cleaning oil pipe. And was able to film his attempt to really start his life there in Williston, and he was beginning to do that. And he brings his wife or his girlfriend and his little baby out. They're living in a camper. End up living in, I think he probably lived in five or six different places over the time that I filmed with him. And he goes looking for a campsite at one point and gets turned down because there's no room in the campground. And then he ends up living in this trailer in this little town called Wheelock, which is, to call it a town is an overstatement. It's like where two roads cross, and his girlfriend looks around and is like, "Oh my God, what have I gotten myself into?" And you realize just how, I mean, did they really feel like, you know, this is like Dust Bowl life, like this is a, you know, this little family trying to survive in this tiny trailer. Nick Keegan, you know, he's a real sweet kid and an optimist, and I really got to know him and love him, but his life takes an unexpected turn, and I'll let the audience discover what that is, but it's quite painful. And I mean, I think I always thought that Keegan in the film was my winner. You know, there's so much. I think what this film shows is how truly difficult it is, was, and is to survive in North Dakota in this oil boom. But I always felt like I didn't set out to pick people who would necessarily succeed or fail. I picked the people who grabbed me, you know, who I connected with. And I thought, Keegan is my winner. You know, this is the kid who's going to make it. And that broke my heart to see what happened.
Mm. Yes, he's an example of someone, in a sense, without the rough, raw edges of some of these other guys who came to Williston with all kinds of baggage, skeletons in their closets, and all kinds of sort of personal battles they might be winning or losing, and so on. And one looks at them and can really understand why small town Americans might be really scared to have them suddenly living there. But someone like Keegan Edwards does not come bearing that kind of checkered past. And yet
no,
even
he's really pure of heart, and yet if the cruel hand of fate strikes him down, mm-hmm. It's like none of these guys could outrun their destiny, I guess. You know, yeah, you can understand for someone like Alan, who's the pastor's right hand, who has a criminal record, or, you know, Michael, who has just, you know, many struggles in his life. I mean, these are guys who, you know, it's hard to outrun that stuff. Keegan's got nothing to outrun. He's just got promise ahead of him. So, you know, we screened the film in Williston in December, and that was a very exciting moment for me. And I remember some people in the community stood up and asked about that. And actually, there were some overnighters in the audience who stood up and said, you know, I just want the community to know that I did make it, you know, and Jay's program helped me find a foothold in the community, and I've built a life here. And I think it was something that Jay and I constantly talked about, which was how many of these guys were surviving, because many of them seemed to be failing, but how many that he was helping. And this is a question that the congregation was debating with him, is, you know, should we be doing this? Is this the community that we should be serving? If we don't help them, maybe they're not going to survive anyway, so why should we give them a place to sleep? And Jay felt, and I said, Jay, how many of these guys are making it? You know, and of course, he didn't have any scientific data to provide. It wasn't that kind of thing. But his position was, for him, it wasn't whether or not they succeeded or failed. It was, did he give them a chance to try to succeed? You know, and as long as he gave them a chance, that was what was important to him.
Jesse Moss is the director, producer, and cinematographer for this outstanding documentary called The Overnighters, airing tonight on Milwaukee PBS Channel 10 and on PBS stations across the country. And if you would like more information, you can also go to the PBS website, pbs.org. My thanks to Jesse Moss for joining me today on The Morning Show. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha. Online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities online at carthage.edu. Now 2 minutes before 9 on this Monday, June the 29th. We'll be joining Wisconsin Public Radio at 9 o'clock for their classical music programming. Let's check the WGTD forecast now from the National Weather Service. A cloudy day today, 50-50 chance of rain moving in, a high of 75. Perspective on that number, normal high this time of year is 79. The record high was 100 degrees. We hit that on June 29th, 1931. Tonight, cloudy. Again, a 50% chance of rain. The overnight low 59. Tuesday, cloudy. Again, a 50% chance of rain. Tomorrow's high 79. Then ahead of that, Wednesday and Thursday, sunny in the 70s. Friday, maybe some rain, a high of 76. 4th of July, Saturday, partly sunny and 75. Sunday, partly sunny and 80. Here are the numbers right now. Humidity high at 83%. Pretty good cloud cover, 64 degrees for Racine and Kenosha. Some light rain now cropped up in Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva with 60 degrees. 65 in Milwaukee, wind is calm. Looking at the radar, there is rain to the west moving into the area right now. That's why we see those raindrops in Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Just about 9 o'clock, this is WGTD HD. Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. Classical music programming from Wisconsin Public Radio up next.